Hey, g'day there, fellow humans. Mark Labuska. My guest this week is a young fella by the name of Dylan Roos, who is a masculinity coach, and he's a fascinating fella. He, even at the ripe old age of 27, he is using what he's learnt in his life to help particularly younger men, but also some old bastards, as he talks about in the thing, to step into their masculinity. And today he's going to talk a bit about that sort of stuff. And I was just fascinated by his wisdom and also by his willingness to share some stories, and particularly of how things haven't gone all that well for him and how he's had to learn and do some work on himself, like, spending a couple of months alone in the woods in the US to discover a bit more about himself and to put that into practice in his work. I think you're really going to enjoy this one. He is incredible. I could have kept talking to Dylan for quite a bit more time, but have a listen, see what you think. And I'm sure you're going to get a lot out of this, regardless of gender or whatever. You'll take a lot, so grab some notes as well.
Life can get pretty complicated. In the Simply Practically Human podcast, Mark Labuska talks to incredible humans to see the way forward more clearly through the complexity in the world and in our heads. Let's get ready to thrive.
Today, absolutely delighted to be joined by masculinity coach Dylan Roos. Dylan, thanks for joining me, mate.
Thanks, Mark, for having me. It's been in the diary for a few weeks now, so I've been looking forward to this conversation.
Mate, as I have too, and I guess we're gonna cover a whole lot of things today. But I really wanted to get you on because there's some incredible work that you're doing with not just younger men, but also with men who aren't as old as me, but a little bit less old is what I am. And I really want to get into this topic of masculinity, and particularly I know your passion for this, so we'll go there. But before we jump into that, I could be putting myself in a precarious position here, mate, but I always like to start with how we met, your first impressions, and I'll give you some of you as well, but you go first as the guest.
Oh, first impressions. So we didn't meet at Fiji. We met at the hotel in Albert Park, a Bleak House Hotel.
That's right.
First impressions. Okay. I reckon I thought you were a bit of a hard ass. I reckon you were very blunt and strong-willed, I remember thinking. That was my first impression, I reckon. Like, very, if you remember the colors, very eagle, very red eagle, very driven, CEO type, no bullshit. Yeah, that sort of person, I think. That was my first impression.
There you go, mate. I always love it when people just go bang straight away. I haven't had the old...
mate, I'm not going to lie to you.
I know you won't, because my bullshit detectors will go off very quickly with you, mate, and that's exactly what I like about you. You don't lie. That's interesting, because I cop intimidating every now and again and hard-ass and a few of those bits and pieces. But
not a bad thing, not in a bad way either.
No, look, I think it's always...
CEO type.
I think it's always good to be reminded by how other people see you rather than how you like to see yourself. And I guess we'll get into some of that. But for me, with you, I was like, he's young. He's young to be doing this sort of work, and he's young to be into this sort of stuff. But I guess one of the things I quite enjoyed, mate, was that you were up for a conversation. And another thing that came out, even though you're a bit younger than me, and I don't want to make this about age because it's not, but
you were more than... Only a couple of years.
Yeah, only a couple of decades, more like it, not a couple of years. But the interesting thing was that you were up for conversations with anyone, and I didn't get that sense that you're a bit like intimidated to be talking to people. And then when we got to Fiji, geez, I hope we get another one of these happening in 2022, because it was incredible. I had Bree on here not long back from then. and still keep in touch with quite a few people from there. But look, I remember spending a bit of time with you and over in Fiji, getting to know you a bit more, and then really fascinated by the work. What do you remember about Fiji? We had the same golf group, didn't we?
We did. We had the same golf group. The standout conversation for me was when we were at the bar. You and I were having a conversation after one of the days of speakers, and you gave me a great gem of advice that I've taken with me the last however long. What's that, 3 years ago now, I think, however long it was, which was a reaffirmation, but probably the first time it really stuck with me. I've, I speak about, and I'd heard the circle and how important the circle is, but I think you put it in a way that really made it practical to audit my circle. And I actually do it now with my boys, and I have my clients do this exercise where at the end of every year, I audit my circle. So I try to take out one energy drainer, was what you called them, get rid of one energy drainer and bring in one person that makes me feel good or is good for my circle. And I've been doing that the last 2-3 years pretty consistently, where I really audit it and I take a really intentional look at my circle and take one person out and bring one person in. And it's been fantastic. And I'll never forget sitting at the bar after one or two beers and having that conversation with you.
Interesting. I remember that conversation really. And I remember your reaction to it. It was like, yeah, this sounds really important. But I remember walking away thinking, this has been a moment for me where he's like, this is a level of discomfort here that I could see, because you were like, hang on, these people have been important to me, and they. Yeah. But I'm realizing where I'm heading to is they're not that they're not important anymore, but they won't serve me well, or maybe I won't serve them well to get to where I need to get to. And what I'm delighted about, mate, is that you grabbed hold of that and done something with it, because I think that's an important part too there. Mate, some other things that I've been following you, because you've outrun COVID pretty well is what I get the sense of. You seem to be one step ahead of COVID. I don't know how you do it, Dill, but something's going on there. I've seen you jumping into bloody, I think, snow, and I've seen you jumping into really cold water, and it looked like at one stage you might have been like doing a bit of a bloody, what's his name, Bear Grylls type thing of almost living on your own in a cabin somewhere. What was going on there, mate?
Yeah, so pretty fortunate that I was able to leave the country last year and get over to America. And I did spend 2 months by myself in my grandparents' cabin up in Lake Tahoe, so in the snow. And I did that because I just come out of a relationship, and my patterns post-breakup were very evident and very self-destructive. So I'd break up with a girl, I would then go on alcohol-fueled rampage and just kind of drink a lot and try to, you know, sleep around with as many women as I could. And then I'd get to a point where I got bored of that, find myself a partner, settle down for 6 months and just repeat. So I really wanted to go into the cabin by myself and do a lot of work and be comfortable being alone. I was never comfortable being alone. I would, for my entire life that I can remember, every night it would get to 9 o'clock at night and I'd be like really nervous or anxious, or like, okay, I need to have mates over, or I need to get a girl over, or I need to be playing PlayStation. I was really uncomfortable with being alone. And so that 2 months in the cabin in the snow was really helpful for me, really, really helpful to just be really comfortable being alone and being okay with being alone. And it was really powerful for me.
So just on that, so it's like that sense of belonging that we all crave as human beings. As you were going through those 2 months, my sense would be early days, the level of discomfort must have been off the charts, because, you know, 9 o'clock comes and you're freaking out a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
What did you notice about the shift in yourself through that time around, you know, your belief systems, your behaviors, your values, that's really helped you to maybe start to break some of those patterns?
Yeah. I think one massive piece was just sitting alone with whatever that needed to come up. Like, I cried so much in that 2 month period, which as guys and as blokes, we don't do nearly enough of. So for me, I really deliberately made myself sit there, think about what I need to think about, journaled a lot, spent a lot of time meditating, just a lot of time outside. Like, I'd go for hikes by myself and try to limit the distractions. And, you know, the first week was probably tough. And then the last week was really tough. So, and that was kind of an indication that, okay, now it's time to get out of here. I've been here for, I think it was about 7 weeks. So I think I was like, yeah, no, now I started feeling really bad. So it's like, okay, now it's time to get back into the real world. So that was a massive piece. And then the second one was just deconstructing the value that I placed on outside validation around who I was and just becoming more genuinely confident about who I was, genuinely, authentically confident about who I was and being okay with whatever that man was really facing me in the mirror. You know, a lot of stuff came up around my past relationships with women and how I've treated them and the real value that I'd placed on that and what it did to me internally. So yeah, it was really good. And as I mentioned to you just off of the last podcast, just before we jumped on the podcast, sorry, I met another girl. We dated and we lived together for the past 4 months and we've just broken up too. And, you know, now I'm kind of going through that process again and having to see, okay, have I learned my lesson or have I, what's coming up now for me? And am I being healthy? Am I being unhealthy? What's happening now? And gauge that over the next 2 to 3 months and really see, okay, is there tangible growth? I think in this space that I work in, there's a lot of people saying the right things and very few people doing the right things. And so I try my best to do rather than to say too much. So that's why it was really important too for me to get into the woods last year, because I'm a coach and I'm coaching people and I want to be able to show up as the best version of myself.
I love it, mate. Thanks for sharing some pretty personal stuff there. So let's wind it back pre-cabin, pre the business that you're doing. Let's go back to the backstory of Dylan Russo. There must have been some things shaping you up over time from, you know, some of your earliest memories of you as a young man, as yep. you know, boy to young man, whatever you want to call it. But give us a bit of the backstory of you, where you grew up and sort of the yep. things that have influenced you to head down this pathway.
Mm. So grew up in Sydney, obviously under unusual circumstances with dad coaching the Swans. So I grew up really heavily involved in football, heavily in a football culture around a lot of really great male role models. They really instilled discipline, hard work, those things into me from an early age, really driven by mum and dad. And then went to a private boys' school, Cranbrook, all boys' school. So just a lot of men and really seeing that inside culture into what the private boys' school does bring and how the average young man acts. And I remember in my first kind of like, I guess, the very earliest stage of this coaching journey that I'm now on that kind of stuck with me was we had a life coach come in and speak to us there. And I remember listening to him speak going, geez, how do you be a life coach? That sounds awesome. Like coaching other people how to live their lives. And I remember dad or mum saying to me, you know, you have to go out and live your life a little bit before you could be a life coach. You can't just roll out at 18 and just start telling people how to live their lives. So that's what I did. I went out and I studied at college, a Bachelor of Sports Management. I worked in construction in California, real estate agent, hospitality for a few years, marketing. I did an internship at Sony at New Balance. I did an internship at a sports agency and really just put myself in every position that I could to figure out what I wanted to do. And the next, I guess, big driver or big life event that happened to me, which really pushed me into this space down the track, was when I was about 20, 21, I went through a really bad breakup with my girlfriend at the time. As you can see, Mark, there's a bit of a pattern here emerging with me and women. And went through a really bad breakup with my girlfriend at the time. And I just really did not handle that well at all. A surface level, I was going great. I was going fine. Like I was living in Coogee in a beautiful apartment that my parents had bought for me and my best mate. We were living there, going to university, having the greatest time of our lives. But underneath the surface, I was really battling away with what was going on in my personal life and was not addressing it at all. I lost all my good habits. I stopped working out. I started eating really poorly. I wasn't meditating, wasn't journaling. I wasn't spending too much time outside in nature or in sun. I was very much like hungover most of the day, drinking most nights. And so that led to 6 months of really destructive behavior, led to me not leaving my bedroom for an entire week. And I was like, fuck, okay, this isn't a hangover anymore. There's something else going on. And so that's when I went and saw a psychologist, and that's when he diagnosed me with depression and anxiety. And so that was the wake-up call that I needed, or this little aha moment where I went, I felt two things. One was a sense of relief of, okay, I'm now aware of an issue or a problem and I can start to address this. Whereas previously I was just running on autopilot and doing what blokes do best, which is just numbing myself. And then the second piece was just a real overwhelming sense of guilt. Who was I to be depressed? Who was I to feel anxious? What the fuck do I have to feel sad and, you know, depressed and anxious about? Look at my life, my parents are together, no deaths, great friends around me. Like, who am I to feel depressed and anxious? And so that was what I worked, you know, working through that over the last 5 years or so. I moved down to Melbourne. Mum and Dad were like, "If you need to get, you need to get the fuck out of Sydney and come back, come to Melbourne and live with us." So moved to Melbourne, really started to get back my good habits back on track, and that's when, you know, as I said, I explored a bunch of different career paths, where ultimately I got to a place where I was trading in the financial markets, actually by myself and a couple of mates. We were trading Forex, and Mum and Dad wanted me to study on the side, something a bit more long term. So I started studying health coaching. And halfway through the health coaching course, I was like, "Oh, coaching, that's right." Like, I kind of remembered the life coach. I remembered coaching. I was like, "Yeah, I want to coach people. That'd be awesome." So I started off as a health coach. Then Dad and I started a business together, which you're aware of, which was the Ruse Men's Wellness and Leadership Club. And that was my first taste in the men's space, where we took CEOs, leaders, upper management level guys, and really challenged them on their wellness habits. So our first event was a 50 bloke breakfast where we did yoga, meditation, and a couple of speakers, which was so cool to see 50 guys doing yoga, old bastards such as yourself doing yoga, mate. It was great. And that really sparked that drive and that passion for helping guys. I really wanted to help guys. And then the more time I just spent in the space, the more time I just fell in love with it, fell in love with helping guys, seeing men open up for the first time in years and talk about things that they've never felt comfortable talking about, just having these awesome conversations. And from there, started another business called the Momentum Lifestyle Project with two business partners, Blake and Genoa, where we work with, you know, 30, 35 plus year old men, help them with their confidence, balance, purpose, and masculinity. And we really drive home some really great ideas and topics in our 10-week mentorship there. And then that's when last year, about 12, 14 months ago, I got really niche on my business and I started working with young boys 14 and up because of my experience, because of, you know, I think the average young man leaves high school and they're quite lost. They lose so much structure that high school provides for them. And they, you know, for me, I was a really good athlete growing up and I didn't pursue AFL or basketball. So it was like, well, I don't know what else there is out there to do. And so that's what really drove my, and then obviously my depression and anxiety and my breakup there. So that really fueled my desire to help young men. And that's been an awesome 14-month journey so far, where now here we are on the podcast. So that's my life story, mate. You've gotten
quite I like your life story. I like the fact that you're able to throw in old bastards like me as well. But you got that in. So what I picked that in there. What I picked up from that deal, which is terrific, is there is hope for old bastards. So if you're an old bastard and you're listening to this, there is hope for you.
Exactly.
So Prince to King, is that what it's called? I'll come to that later on, but I think this is a tremendous program and experience that you're creating for young men. I wanted to ask you about just masculinity in itself. I guess it's open for interpretation about what it means. You hear lots of things, toxic masculinity, a whole lot of stuff. What I'm really keen to understand is, what does that term mean to you?
For me, it's masculinity is inherently positive. There's nothing toxic about what masculinity is or is meant to be. And the same goes for femininity, right? And you brought up, you know, you've already said the term toxic masculinity, right? And whenever we think masculinity, the first thing we think is toxic masculinity. And it's really sad because, as I said, masculinity is positive. What true masculinity is and what it stands for is great, just like the same is to be said about femininity. But we don't hear anything about toxic femininity. There's no buzzwords around that. It's all buzzwords around toxic masculinity, getting rid of the patriarchy, all that, if I'm speaking bluntly, all that nonsense. So when I think of masculinity, I think of what it's meant to be or what true examples of masculinity is. You know, the great leaders that we've seen throughout history, the great men that we've seen throughout history, and the great men we see today. I think what we've done is we've taken men and poor examples of men and attributed that with masculinity. And that's not the same thing. It is a very fine difference when we're talking about, I'm a masculinity coach, I'm helping create in the young men positive ideals, positive values, positive ideas around what it means to be a man, whilst identifying, here are some examples that society tells us, you know, you need to make a lot of money, you need to get a lot of girls, you need to be funny, you need to be good at sport, you need to be aggressive, you need to be the alpha, right? We want to start to deconstruct them, look at them and say, okay, what's positive about making money, right? Well, fuck yeah, you get to make money and you get to make a living. You get to provide for the people in your life. That's really great. Now, what happens when you attribute your entire value as a man to money?
Yep.
That's not a good thing, right? You need to develop yourself as a whole person, a whole man, and attribute value where it is necessary, right? We think of masculinity, and we've done a bunch of studies and surveys through our business momentum around, well, what is masculinity? What is a modern day man, right? And the things, the buzzwords are coming, you know, empathetic, good communicator, still the old, more old school way, still strong, still the rock, right? But it's this combination of backbone and heart. And
yep.
We've seen a really, throughout the last, up until about the early 2000s, it was all backbone and no heart. And now we're seeing a massive swing of the pendulum to all heart. And honestly, with the boys that I'm working with, very little backbone. And so I found that the guys my age, maybe mid-20s to mid-30s, early 40s, probably have the best balance of the two because of just the timing that they've been brought up in. And, you know, as I said, the last 20 years has been really focused on emotional intelligence, heart. And so they've got a little bit of balance of the two, but still a long, long way to go for most men in finding whatever that balance looks like for them. And that's a big piece of it too. When we want to celebrate the differences, there's no cookie cutter, like this is what a man is. For me, it's like, let's look at the positive attributes that you've currently got. And let's look at the areas for improvement that you've currently got. And let's start to make yourself a more complete man. And that comes back to that backbone and heart, that grit and resilience and that wisdom and emotional intelligence. And that's really how I view masculinity, is that balance, that combination of the two.
My observations has been that there's potentially been a bigger swing to the heart stuff, and the heart stuff's important. You know the work that I do, which critical for me. I do wonder though that we've lost a bit of that other stuff, that resilience, the grit. I just spoke to another guy recently about human durability, this ability for us to have really challenging conversations before we step into something that's hard, so that we can understand where we're at. What are your thoughts around that, mate? You've just said we need to find somewhere in between, but if the pendulum swings too far to heart, what have you noticed that's some of the dangers that happen in that space?
Oh, well, you have no ability to endure any adversity in your life. You go into any challenge and you crumble. And we've put such an important, and it was necessary, but again, we want to find the balance. It was a necessary conversation that they'd had. The mental illness, mental health conversation has been so necessary, but you have to look at the cons to having that conversation and the cons to having it too frequently and not still keeping the resilience conversation in mind. I'll put it to you, Mark. How many days have you had to get up for work when you felt like, well, I'd honestly rather be on the golf course, or I'd rather stay in bed, or I'd rather sleep in?
Yep, plenty of days.
But you get up and there are days where I've got responsibilities and I need to do what I need to do. The whole conversation around mental health, mental illness is focused on how do you feel and respecting how you feel. If you don't feel good, stay home, right? If you don't feel good, don't do it. And whilst it's important to figure out internally what that balance is, it's an internal game, right?
Yep.
I need to, for my life, figure out, okay, how hard can I push myself? How many days in a row where I don't feel like getting up and doing what I need to do before I need to respect my emotions and say, okay, I do need a day off today.
Yeah. Yep.
But that's different to how many days you can go. You might be able to go 2 months and then you need a week break, and then you can go another 2 months. I might be able to go 5 days and I need my weekend to relax, you know? So everyone's different. But the danger of just focusing on how you feel is, Mark, how do you feel today? Oh, not great, mate. Stay home, brother. Get into bed. Let me order you some McDonald's on that beautiful device you've got here. And let me just, hey, also, while you're at it, why don't you get up your favorite movie on the computer? And, you know, if you're a young man, just start swiping on your phone and you'll get a girl to come over in an hour and she can give you a cuddle. You know, that it's, we live in such a society where if you want something, you can pretty much get it. So it's not a great place to make decisions based on how you feel, you know, whether that's in business, whether that's on the footy field, in sport, life, right? You want to make a decision that takes into account how you feel, but has some logic to it. So that's the importance of the balance, is if you're too much in the heart, every day you get up and you don't feel like doing something, you don't do it. Yeah. Another word is discipline. You need discipline in your life. Okay, here's my morning routine. I wake up at 6 a.m. every morning. I meditate. I then go exercise, come home, have my coffee, and read my book, right? And I do that every single day without failure, right? That's going to build discipline in your life that will spill out into other areas because, Matt, I love to exercise and I try. When I'm doing really well, I'm exercising 6 days a week. When I'm not doing well, I'm still hitting my 2-3 times a week, right? I'll never go a week without exercising. Even I've been on the Gold Coast last week. I've hit the gym 3 times. I'm going to go again this afternoon and I've had an off week routine wise, right? But what keeps me coming back is the discipline, is the grit, is the, I'd rather stay home, but I know that if I stay home, it's not going to make me feel better. I know if I go and go to the gym, it's actually going to make me feel better.
Yeah.
So that's the importance of it. And as I said, it was necessary to take the conversation this way. And hopefully the next 10 to 20 to onwards years, it is like, hey, mate, how do you feel today? Not great. Well, what have you done the last week? I've drank a lot of alcohol. I've eaten a lot of takeout and I haven't been to the gym yet. It's like, well, why don't you cut the alcohol, get a good smoothie in and then hit the gym rather than saying, I don't feel well today, so I'm going to stay in bed, right?
So I sense a bit that there's no one size fits all, that there's a uniqueness around it. But at the same time, that we need to find the right balance here or help people in their uniqueness to uncover the patterns. And you know, these patterns of masculinity that you were speaking about for yourself, I'm just interested, not too much to dig into yours. You can go wherever you want here, but with the work that you do, what are some of the common patterns that show up for the repeating patterns for men?
Yeah.
That they either become aware of, Dill, and they choose to look away from.
Yeah.
Or they become aware of them and then they decide to do something about it. What are some of those common patterns that turn up?
Yeah. So we've got 4 pillars in our momentum business, and I'll speak more to momentum. So we've got muscle, mindset, masculinity and mission. And under those 4 pillars is where we see a lot of the work that men need to do. And I guess in that, what the men love working on or come to us to work on is more this piece around they want to create better connections in their life. They want to find more balance in their life. They want to step into their purpose more. And then confidence is a big one too. So they're the 4 commonalities that we see across the men that we work with. And similar with the young boys that I work with, it'd be very similar. Maybe not so much the purpose piece for the young boys, but definitely when they hit 17, 18, they're thinking about what do I want to do with my life and where do I want to go? So that's really common. I think the catalyst that seems to be 80, 90% of guys that get them into the work is some form of breakup. It's some form of rock bottom. And honestly, I don't have it right in front of me and we haven't really looked at it from a statistical standpoint, but I would say 80% of blokes go through a breakup and go, okay, I need to sort my shit out now.
Yeah.
I think that's a real big catalyst for change and catalyst for wanting to do the internal work is realizing, oh shit, I might have some stuff that I need to work on here because it's showing up in my relationship. So,
and those patterns could have been playing out forever as well. Like that could be something that started at an early age and it's still going through someone's life when they're an old bastard, as you referred to me before, mate. So there's an interesting piece that sort of triggered me before because, and this will sort of start to get us into, I think, a conversation around dads and sons.
Yeah.
Because I had Sam on here. So Sam's about your age, mate. Sam came onto my podcast because he's been working from home for a long time. It goes into the office a bit, but long way before COVID. And he came on to give some tips early days of COVID about, you know, what are some things you can do? And I asked him a question right near the end, which was either fucking brave or stupid or both. And I sort of said, what advice would you have given me as a gamer back in, you know, your 14s to 15s? And I don't think I'm going to get this exactly right, but it was something like, sort of fucking listen to me a bit more, like, and don't judge me. And he also made it fair that he judged me as well. And I remember reading something you wrote at one stage about your relationship with your dad. And as much as, you know, people like Paul Roos and, you know, Roosie's been on here as well. Paul's been on the podcast, but you sort of, he was your dad.
Yeah.
And you talked a bit about, you know, even though he was someone who was famous and feted by people. He was your dad. And can you remember sort of having any of those moments as well along the way where it's like, geez, Dad, just give us a bit of space and let me do some stuff?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Any big moments like that? I think it probably came later on in life. I think, actually the big one when I was 16 years old and quit footy for about half a season.
Yep.
And something that I tell parents all the time is, and I'll speak to young men because that's what I work with. I'm not sure if women are the same. I don't know. So I'll speak more to young men, but there is such an innate drive within young men when they hit 14 to have control over their own lives. And it happens about 14. They want to be making their own decisions. And so I think the best thing that parents can do is within reason and still being a parent-son relationship and still having responsibility and rules in place is let your kids make as many mistakes as possible and make them make as many decisions as possible, because the negative consequences at 14, 15, 16 are not that great within reason. Again, you're still the parent, you're still the son, you still got rules and boundaries in place. They can't take the car at 14 and drive off and do whatever they want, right? You're still the adult and they're still the kid, but the mistakes they're going to make, that's the time that they need to make them. Because if I make one mistake and I learn my lesson at 15, 16, right, I've still got my entire life, or I can still make changes and it's not going to have a massive impact on me. I make that mistake at 30, 32, and I haven't learned that lesson. Well, I've got 16 years where I haven't learned the lesson, and now I'm 30, 32, just learning the lesson. Yep. And now I've got to practice whatever it is that I've learned. So I think that the big thing that stepped out for me was when I quit footy at 15 and I was crying and angry and yelling, and the whole thing was just let me make that decision. And parents love to say, people, parents, teachers, coaches, me as a mentor, we love to put an old head on young shoulders. Hey, mate, we can see better than you can see. If you do this decision, it's going to end up here. So don't make the decision. You can't look at it that way. Go make the decision yourself. You'll learn the lesson yourself. You have to have an amount of faith in your kid that he's not a dumbass.
Love it.
You know, that he's going to make the mistake and going to be okay, that he's going to land on his feet. You know, I quit footy and that's absolutely what I wanted to do at the time. Quit footy, spent 6 months out of the game, realized I fucking miss footy, love it, and came back. I still played state footy. I still played Swans Reserves. I still played the highest level that I could at the time at 17, 18. I just needed a break. Yep. Like my entire life was football. Dad was dad. Everything was round up. I wanted to go and spend more time playing tennis, spend more time playing basketball, right? So they're really difficult conversations because the parents know better, right? What happened? I ended up coming back to footy. So mum and dad are probably sitting there going, you've wasted 6 months. Whereas I'm going, I learned that lesson. I needed to make that decision for myself. I can't be seen to be controlled. And that's what young men and men, and you have a boss, to bring it back to your work, you have a boss that micromanages you. Like, you don't want to work for that person. You want to get out of there. You want to find a new job. You want to do the opposite of what he's saying, even if you know he's right. It's something that I tell parents all the time. I'm like, they will actively go against you just so that they're in control.
Yep.
They will know that's a bad decision, but it's my decision at least. So if you can find a way to communicate with your sons, and it's almost like inception. You want to incept the idea, but it's still their idea. So yep. There's ways to go about it rather than that top. It's so intrinsically linked to business. Top-down approach doesn't work anymore. You have to build a culture. And it's easy for me to say because I don't have kids, but I mentor kids. Yeah. So I have that relationship. But again, when I got older, I'd quit jobs and I'd be 20, 22, and I'd know that that job wasn't right for me. And mum and dad are getting upset because I've just thrown away an opportunity and I'm crying and I'm upset and all I want is to be able to make my own decisions. And the big thing that kept coming back to me, the big thing was, why don't you trust me? Why don't you trust me to make my own decisions? I'm not a fucking idiot. I'm not a kid. I'm not this and that. Why don't you trust me? Even as a young 20-year-old, it was like, trust that I'll be okay.
Yep.
And sure enough, here I am at 27 and I'm okay. I'm living my dream life, my dream job. I'm having a massive impact. And I wouldn't have been able to get here without the journey that I'd gone on, without that breakup that caused me to be depressed and anxious, without quitting a job, maybe prematurely, without finishing up uni and going, uni's not for me, I'm leaving, and not finishing my degree. I reckon mum pushed me to go back to college for 3 years. And I was just like, nope, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
That's not where my life's going. Oh, but just get the degree and just do that. And, you know, at least you've got it there. You're almost done. And it was like, mum, that's just not what I want to do. Trust me. trust me that I can look after myself. And so, yeah, as you can tell, plenty of examples pop into mind.
Yeah, it's good, mate. Look, again, thanks for sharing. And just thinking as you were talking about trust, you know, and then this like who knows better? And it's easy to be thinking about that when I guess you're a parent because, you know, I remember with Sam, like Sam's a gamer and Sam works in IT now and he loves gaming and he still does at 28 today, actually. Happy birthday, Sam. But you know what I used to say to him, mate, come out the back and I'll throw 500 balls till you hit your off drive. And he'd be like, he'd come out there, but you could tell. Yep. And in the end, he would play what I'd call a stupid shot, which I'd get shitty with him on because that was his way of going, fuck you. Because I actually don't want to be here. And then there's that other piece about, you know, college and uni and ATAR scores and all this sort of stuff as well, which I just often wonder, mate, about how much parents drive that for their own cause.
Yeah.
More so than for the, and I'm going to say, you know, young men, and for young girls and young women as well. And I guess I want to go there a bit now and some of your tips here. I'd like to get some simple and practical tips here that you could give to parents. One you gave straight away, I love you've given, do not fucking micromanage your kids. If you're a manager in the workplace and you're anti-micromanagement, don't do it to your kids. So that was a good one. But what other things do you suggest to parents who are maybe caught up in this, you know, the 14 to 17 year old boy who grunts at you for 3 years?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was me.
Fucking that was Sam as well. Yeah. And most likely me. I remember one day telling my old man who was a runner at our footy club in Mildura, mate, even though I was a big bloke, I was a bit fucking frightened when I used to play footy every now and again. And I didn't go hard one day and he ran out. And before he got to me, I just told him to fuck off.
Yeah.
Just fuck off with your message. And he sort of looked at me like, I'm thinking about that. Where's that moment where it's like it's on? But what advice do you give to parents, mate, to maybe step out of that a bit?
Well, I think the number one non-negotiable is you need other, if we're talking for sons, you need other men in their lives that they can go to and trust, whether that's an uncle, whether that's your best mate. You need to create a tribe of men that can mentor your son because he's not going to listen to you. He won't listen to you from 14 to 18, 19, 20. He's not going to listen to you. But if you trust your own parenting up until 14, you've laid the groundwork. You're happy with that. Perfect. Now you need other people to come in and take over. Like, and you have to drop your ego. Dad was the best AFL coach in the world. And I thought he was a fucking moron.
Yep.
And I thought he was an idiot. And he tried to coach me and my brother, and it always ended in arguments. We didn't see him as Paul Roos, the coach. We saw him as Paul Roos, the dad, who we knew better.
Yep.
And that's the same as every kid looking at their dad. So you need to create a tribe of people around them, people that you trust, and you have to be the ones that are selecting them. Don't leave it up to your mate to go to advice to his friends because his friends don't know any better. Okay? And that's what Steve Bidoff talks about a lot, who's a leading child psychologist, is he says, have a really heavy hand on who you bring around your son's life. Like, encourage your friends to be your son's friends or your kid's friends, right? I've got great relationships with some of Dad's ex-teammates, mates. I'll go for coffees with them. I'll catch up with them. Some of Mum's friends, I'll do the same thing because they're going to say, if you are friends with them, we're assuming that they're good people. So they're probably going to say the same thing that you would say. The only difference is I'm going to listen to my dad's best mate. I'm not going to listen to dad. So that has to be the most practical, best thing that you can do. And if you're doing that, it also means you're giving advice less. If I'm receiving advice every single day, it doesn't feel like advice and it doesn't feel like it's coming from a good place. What it feels like is, again, you don't trust me to live my life. But let's say you have mentors, you've got other people that are around, you're allowing me to make mistakes and I'm going out in the world. I'm probably going to come to you and go, hey, mom, dad, what do you think about this? It might end in an argument because I might not like what you have to say and I might go, fuck you, I disagree with your advice.
Yep.
But it's better than that micromanagement. It's funny, I've had a couple really difficult clients and it's hard because I'm mentoring the boys and oftentimes the parents need some mentoring too. And I'm not there. They're paying me not to mentor them. So it's difficult because I'm trying to say, hey, maybe if you just let your son make some of these mistakes that aren't, look, they're not great mistakes to be made, but he's going to keep doing this negative behavior until he feels like he's in control, you know? So it's such a difficult balance. Parenting is the hardest thing in the world. I'm not a parent. I'm mentoring these boys, but it's so hard. Like, I have so much empathy for parents, but I just think if you can learn, there's a great quote. I can't remember who said it or where I read it or saw it, but the reason that you micromanage is because you feel uncomfortable in yourself. It's not necessarily you are uncomfortable sitting in the unknown. Your kid's fine in the unknown. Your kid's thriving and doing stuff in the unknown. You're actually uncomfortable. So you need to feel like I've got control over the situation, and that's not healthy. You need to look at the solution. What's the goal you want? I want a son who thinks for himself, who shows up empathetically and strong-minded, and I want a son who can critically think, right? The only way you learn critical thinking, that last one, is by making mistakes and going, that's not a thing, that's not, nope, until you get to my age where you're mid-20s and then you're starting to make a lot more good decisions than bad decisions. The only reason I'm able to do that is because I've made 1,000 different mistakes, but they weren't that lethal to me. They were bad. Don't get me wrong, especially some of them were really bad, but I'm still here and I've learned as a result. So you can't be the helicopter parent because you don't raise resilient kids. No resilient child's ever been born out of helicopter parents because they never go through challenges. I was dating a teacher and she was saying how parents now will call up the school when their kids have forgotten homework, right? Every kid now has a phone. So even at like 10 years old, they text, oh my God, I've left the homework at home, and the parent calls up and goes, oh, sorry, Nathan left his homework, but I'm driving it down right now. And it's like, no, let your kid forget his homework. Mm. Let him get into trouble. It's not the end of the world. And then next time he'll remember his homework.
I remember, I think you might have heard this from me because you came into my program, but I'd say to let people sit in their catastrophe for a while and feel it, because that's such an important thing. Like, you know, letting people make safe mistakes is important. I used to say that to my kids, make mistakes, but make safe ones or small ones rather than big ones. And then later on you hear a story about how Sam was in the boot of a car driving up the Hume Highway from Wallen to Seymour to get to a party. And I'm like, fucking hell, mate. You didn't tell me that till you're in your 20s, but like that sort of stuff, that's not good.
Yeah.
Taking some of those workplace things, like, you don't always have to be in control. You don't have to micromanage it. And taking them back into the family life, and that's one of the real challenges for people in corporate life. You can get lots of people who do amazing leadership things in the workplace, and then they come home and they're a fucking disaster.
Yeah. One parent said to me really eloquently, he was talking about how his son wanted to go camping with a few of his mates by a lake. They were country boys. And he's like, yeah, mate, that's fine. I'm gonna be at a campsite just down near you. If you need me, you can call me. I'll be there by myself. I'm more than happy for that. And he put it really well. He goes, I'm okay if you're going to break your arm or your leg. You're a young man. You're going to do that. You're going to do risky behavior. I care if you break your neck. Yes. And I'm trying to stop you from breaking your neck. I'd prefer it if you didn't break your arm or your leg, but that's okay. That's in that realm of safe risk taking. But as a parent, you're like, fuck, please do not break your neck. Like, that is, and I really like the way he put it, because you're like, go break your arm, break your leg, but fuck, please don't break your neck.
I know I've said to my kids, and you've heard this from me too, you're like, the worst thing can happen to me is that I fucking outlive my kids. It's just like, it's not what I want. I don't want to go into that morbidity, by the way. Mate, when I asked your dad this question, his answer was just like, it was fucking gold. I talk about this idea of we overcomplicate stuff at times, and maybe we try and make things complex when they can be more simple. And I think Paul said, like, the simpler it is, the easier it is to understand. And he shared a story about being in a corporate one day and they were using all of this language, and he turned to the young girl next to him and he said, do you get what they're talking about? And she goes, no.
Yeah.
And he goes, nor do I.
Yeah.
What you're talking about here, that there's a level of complexity in this, don't get me wrong, but it can be made more complicated than maybe what it needs to be. In your experience, why do you think that human beings try to go to more complex, complicated solutions and ways of doing things when perhaps there's a simpler answer there that they can either see and they don't want to, or they can't see because they just can't fucking see it?
I think generally speaking, a lot of the simple answers potentially are not the answers we're after. Yep. Like, I think if we're not happy with an answer, we'll try to justify different answers.
Yep.
And so often the simplest ones can be the ones where we're like, oh, I don't want that to be the answer, right? Simple answer, let your kid break his leg. What parent wants their kid to break their leg? No, it has to be something else. There has to be a way that I can raise a resilient child where he never breaks a bone in his body. There has to be a way where I can give him straight A's nonstop. Like, there has to be a way. And so they come up with some complicated way of reasoning it to use that as an example. So I think oftentimes it's just people don't want to accept a simple answer because it's not the answer that they want.
Yep.
And I think a lot of it, I talk a lot about it in my coaching. I talk about it a lot at Momentum with Blake and Genoa. How aware are people of why they make the decisions that they make? There's a real lack of awareness at the moment. And so it's hard to make good decisions from a place of lack of awareness. When I first got diagnosed with depression and anxiety, that first feeling of, oh, there's a problem, I can address it. Great. I'm now aware of the problem, I can address it. If you're unaware of problems or issues or things that are going on, you can't address those issues. You just can't. So I think creating more awareness and asking yourself, why am I making this decision, or what drove me to do that? Which is, again, how do you do that? Simple answer, meditate and journal.
Yep.
Do those two things every single day. In a year's time, you'll be a completely different person and everyone around you will notice. You can attest to it because of the boys that we had in Fiji at Nurture.
Mm.
You know, those guys that walked away and meditated every day for a month were calling me up going, oh my God, my employees are saying how calm I am. They've already noticed a difference in me. They're doing this and that. And it's like, yeah, what have they done? They spent 10 minutes doing nothing every day. You know, simple answer.
Well, mate, you know what? Your mum's going to be delighted with this because I remember I went into a session with her and they were doing meditation and I was struggling with it because I'd been to something one time where they made us like meditate for fucking 4 hours.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't get that out of my head. Let her know that I'm doing the 10, 15 minutes a day now.
Yeah.
Usually I've got myself an infrared sauna as well now. And
oh, awesome.
I got to tell you, even after 5 to 6 weeks, only doing 10 minutes, 15 minutes a day, the difference is incredible. Just, I say for myself, I don't know what other people are experiencing. They might be still experiencing some fucking mad, intimidating, badass dude. I don't know what's going on there, but but it seems to work. So, Tammy, thank you for persevering with me at that time and giving me some things to think about. Mate, I want to finish with Prince to King because the world needs to know about this stuff. And you know, I get listeners on here who'll be challenged by a lot of this stuff at the moment. In fact, when I did that episode with Sam, a couple of my mates were ringing like, fuck, I'm glad I heard that right now because my son's in that age group and now I've got to start to listen to him. Mate, I've read some of the reviews on your work from both kids, young men, the parents as well, and they give me goosebumps and make the old hair stand up on the back of their neck. Such powerful work.
Yeah.
Talk to us about the program and then also about where people can get more information about your program.
Yeah. Yeah, so I spent probably close to 12 months working on the content, what was needed and what I wanted to roll out. And it was really two main questions or main themes that I wanted to do. I wanted to go, okay, what did I need at that age? And secondly, how can we up-level this next generation of young boys or young men? The program is Prince to King. How can I take them from boyhood to manhood? And I'm really passionate about the program. It's as you can tell by the, as you said, the testimonials, you know, there's a process to it. There's reasons. They might come to me for confidence. We don't directly touch on confidence throughout the whole program, but the things that we're talking about, values, behaviors, emotional intelligence, what does healthy masculinity look like? What are our limiting beliefs that we have about ourselves? And working through those things, the end of the program, the boys are coming out more confident, you know?
Yep.
So it's really great. So it's 10 weeks long. My next intake is October 10th of this year, and that'll be the last one that I do this year. So it'll be the last chance to work with me. And it's all one-on-one. So it's all, there's no cookie cutter. There's no one size fits all. I'm working with these boys on the stuff that they want to work on, that they need to work on, that is very unique to their own situation. You know, I am that one-on-one mentor because that's what they need. They don't need some general ideas. They need general ideas with practical solutions to what they are currently going through. And me being 27, every story they tell, I've got three stories back at them, which are the same thing that they're going through, because I vividly remember what it was like to be 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. So Princess King is really, really passionate program that I just love rolling out and love working with these boys.
Mate, I've loved watching you develop it. You said 12 months and I've, you know, been watching your social stuff and everything that's been going on, and to see something as a as an idea, as a concept, to see what's coming at the back end of it is the testimonials from the young men, the testimonials from the parents. I think it's an absolute credit to what you're doing. Let me finish with this one, because you mentioned this before, and I fucking crying. So here's the thing. I'm sure when you're doing this work that there'll be some boys that will get emotional and cry. As you've been in the room with me, and people get emotional and cry, and people say to me, fuck, you're the guy that makes people cry, and I'm sure you cop a bit of that as well.
Yeah.
How do we break the stigma? And it's not just for blokes, it's for women in the room too. Yeah. I'm sorry I'm getting emotional. I'm like, don't be sorry. But for blokes, they're just like sitting there like fucking stunned mullets, not knowing what to do. How do we break the stigma that showing emotion through tears is a weakness versus something that we should embrace?
To bring it back to what Jordan Peterson talks a lot about, one of his main philosophies is self-accountability and self-responsibility and looking at what you can control. The number one thing we can all do is we can all start doing it more. Okay, I understand logically I need to do it. All right, I'm going to go and I'm going to cry in front of my kids, or I'm going to go and do those things. I'm going to let my son see me cry, and I'm going to do it in a way where I'm not a heaping mess on the floor that needs to be picked up. I'm going to do it in a way where, like, I'm releasing emotion, I'm releasing trauma, and I'm doing it in a way that's healthy, and I'm showing that, yes, men can fucking cry, or people can cry. I think what often happens is young men grow up, the only people they see crying are women.
Yep.
They see all their men in their life never crying, and so they go, men don't cry, women cry. Yep. Men don't cry, women cry. So it's subconsciously programmed in us that that's not the thing that we do. The best things that's come out of AFL athletes and celebrities talking about mental illness is that they've got such a big platform to do it, and they're athletes, they're celebrities, so they are people that a lot of people look up to. So like, oh, you're my role model, and as a role model, you're showing me it's okay to talk about these things or it's okay to cry. Great. That unconsciously unlocks something in me that's okay to do now.
Yep.
And so, again, bringing in another practical tip that you can do is bring in other role models to your kids' life. Get them interested in poetry or art or music or architect. Like, bring in other men, not just every young boy's got their favorite athlete, you know? Mm. Which is great. There's nothing wrong with having a favorite athlete, but bring new ideas, bring new people in, have role models in their lives that cry. And if you can't do that as a dad, like if you're like, I don't even know where to start, then get a mate. Like you'll have at least one mate who can comfortably do that or have that in their life. So bring them around more, have them around the house, have those conversations. But it all starts internally. If you want other people to do something and you're not doing it yourself, good luck. You know, if I came to you, Mark, and I said, mate, you need to lose 10 kilos and exercise and work out and eat healthy. And as I'm saying it, I'm eating the cheeseburger and I'm 20 and I'm 20 kilos overweight. You're looking at me going, well, I'm not listening to you. Even though everyone knows that eating better and exercising is good for them. Right? They're not going to listen to the bloke that's not embodied in what he's talking about. So the same thing, if your kids are struggling or your son, you're worried. A lot of parents come and they say, oh, my son doesn't show emotions and I'm worried and he bottled it up and all he is angry and all that. And it's like, well, are you exposing him to other men that are not just angry? You know, what's the one emotion that every son knows that their father has in them is anger.
Yep.
Everyone knows that their dad can be angry and happy. They're the two emotions that we see our dads go through. We don't really see them go through disappointment, sadness, vulnerability. It's very rare. So if you can bring those other emotions in, what's your son going to do? He's going to develop those emotions as well.
Mate, I love it. Fascinating conversation. Prince to King, people. October the 10th is the next intake. We'll get some stuff. We'll get your details for all that sort of stuff. We'll get it put up somewhere on the site when we release this episode. But, mate, so good to have you on. It's been far too long since we've had a conversation. You keep outrunning COVID, mate. You're unbelievable at that. And I appreciate your vulnerability and your masculinity. Thanks, Dil.
Thank you.
One of the things that really stands out for me with Dylan is his willingness to embrace what masculinity is to him and the positive side of it. And I'm going to say to use himself as his own best experiment. And I do talk about experimentation quite a bit. And there's been no better example of someone who's walking their talk. In fact, as I said to him on the podcast, that, you know, goosebump moments and hair standing on up on the back of my neck when I've read some of the testimonials that he's received from both young men that have been through his Prince to King program, as well as some of the parents as well. So worth looking at. He's got his new intake happening on the 10th of October. We're going to provide you with some details on how to get to that. If you go and check out Dylan's website, you will find some details on how to, and look under Prince to King if you're looking for something to help your young fella step into their masculinity and to sort of make that progression from the prince to the king into manhood. It would be a great way to do it. Some of the things that he talked about today that struck a chord with me was that masculinity is a positive thing, but we usually hear about toxic masculinity. But, you know, he's all for embracing the positivity that comes from really practicing masculinity in a great way. Working on yourself, starting there. Surrounding boys and young men with a good tribe of men. So particularly for dads and for parents as well, just for anyone who's maybe single parents here bringing out boys, is they're going to go through that stage, as my son did, 14 to 17, where they grunt at you, and just having some other people around who they'll listen to. Don't try and control them too much. Don't micromanage them, as we say in the workplace. Micromanagement is a bad thing, but we tend to practice it at home to maybe try and bring them up how we think they should be brought up and not make the mistakes that we made. Allow them to make some mistakes. He's really vulnerable, share about his own demons and diagnosis around depression and anxiety and how he was able to use that as something that's helped him to get to where he is today. And I'm going to leave you with this one, that it is okay to cry. Let it happen. Let it happen naturally. Don't have it manufactured. And it may well help, as he says, to get people to see more than perhaps angry dad or happy dad. They might see some other things in between there. If you love this episode, as I always say, get your fingers and thumbs a tapping and rate it 5 stars. Leave a comment if you wouldn't mind about what you liked about it so much. And if you liked it, share it with your friends. Remind you again to check out Dylan's Prince to King program that kicks off on the 10th of October. Really, really worth looking at if you're looking to do something maybe a little bit different with your young fellas. And as Dylan said, it is something that is one-to-one. So it's done very, very much around an individual's requirements. It's not like a cookie cutter situation. So if you go to dylanroscoaching.com, that's dylanroscoaching.com, you can find some information about the program for 10th of October. Until next time, keep it simple. Keep it practical and keep it human. Bye for now.